For the Lore of the Land, this is Jack Leffler. The human species has been a part of the biotic community of the span of landscape now known as the American Southwest for at least 12,000 years, and maybe even much longer. Those early human hunter-gatherers hunted megafauna, now long extinct, and other game that still prevails in the wildlands of the Chihuahuan and Sonoran deserts, the mountains whose peaks comprise the Sky Island Archipelago, the riparian habitats along the Rio Grande and Rio Colorado and their tributaries. The native cultures of today trace their indigeneity to homeland in geomythic and biomythic terms. They continue to this day to celebrate the flow of nature by honoring the local spirits and deities whose presence has honed their spiritual awareness and systems of ethical standards. Thousands of shrines affixed throughout the landscape, most of them invisible to the eye of the outsider, mark mythic encounters and provide coordinates for geomythic mapping of homelands. It is through the lens of mythic perspective that their intuitive perceptions of the sacred nature of homeland pervade cultural consciousness. It was into this sacred space that Spanish colonists trekked ever northward. They were spiritually guided by friars whose single God hovered in heavenly space, transcending the earthly plane of existence. They were protected by armored soldiers mounted on horses, a species heretofore unknown to the natives. The accoutrements of the colonists included artifacts whose purpose eluded the natives. The effect of the initial encounter between colonists and native Indians is unimaginable by today's reckoning. John Roney addresses the impact of the Spanish Entrada on native cultures, both to the east and to the west.
Spaniards were going out onto the plains on a fairly frequent basis, fairly early on, to hunt buffalo. So I'm sure they were having impacts out there, all the way out to Hopi. Missions were settled at Hopi and the other western pueblos. The effects of the Spanish Entrada, I mean, you think about the horse, the impact that the horse had on the plains. There were a few people living out there before the Spanish came, but very few. That was a really hard place to make a living until people had the mobility that the horse provided. Once they acquired horses, people came from all around the plains. I mean, you had woodland tribes from Wisconsin just packing up lock, stock, and barrel and moving out onto the plains and becoming part of this horse culture and hunting the buffalo. That was an incredible fluorescence that affected a big part of the continent, way, way beyond the actual physical presence of the Spanish.
The Spanish learned to hunt buffalo from horseback, using the horse's momentum to help thrust a lance deep into the side of a buffalo. It was a dangerous way to hunt. Los Ciboleros, performed by Virginia Vernal, is a narrative ballad that recounts the tragic tale of an Hispano buffalo hunter whose lance became fouled, the butt end hitting the buffalo, the point of the lance skewering the hunter, killing him.
De los Ciboleros al viaje, mi caballo es más ligero, pero tocó la desgracia que se volcó en un tucero y en eso solté la lanza y me pasó el cuerpo entero. Como a las 3 de la tarde la muerte me sentenció en los brazos de un compadre que ni la mano me dio, en los brazos de un compadre que ni la mano me dio. Como a las 3 de la tarde la muerte me arrebató en los brazos de un compadre que ni Jesús me gritó, en los brazos de un compadre que ni Jesús me gritó. Orillas de una laguna, mi cuerpo está sepultado, como si fuera yo un traidor. Mis hermanos me han dejado como si fuera un traidor. Mis hermanos me han dejado. Cuando esta noticia llegue a Nuevo México entero. Todos tristes sentirán la muerte de un caballero, todos tristes sentirán la muerte de un caballero.
Esteban Rael Galvez is the New Mexico state historian.
The Camino Real did not just foster settlement along the Royal Road, but of course it fostered communication. It's where the laws went back and forth. It also was a trade route. And like any trade routes globally, once you establish them, they're not going to have just a beginning point and an end point. They're going to expand and spiral off into different directions, northward, southward, sideways. The Camino Real is no exception.
Among the livestock to come northward as early as Oñate's expedition was a breed of sheep known as churro sheep. These sheep apparently came originally from Basque country in the Pyrenees Mountains between Spain and France. Many of the early explorers and colonists were Basques and brought the churro sheep into the New World. Early on, churro sheep came into the possession of the Navajo Indians, who prize them to this day. Leo and Sarah Natani live just east of the Chuska Mountains in Navajo country, where they raise churro sheep.
We had rams and churro sheep. We didn't know that we had that kind of a sheep. The snow would get about 2 feet. The churro sheep are long-legged. Their wool starts from their belly on up, and they can go through the snow easily rather than these that have their wool all the way to their hoof. And we had churro sheep, and we used that for our food and our bedding. Didn't have no mattress in those days, so what sheepskin that we have, then we use that for our mattresses.
Weaving, it's part of the culture. If you're a troubled person, if you sit down to your weaving, your bad feeling all goes away and the good one comes in. And then you start thinking about your pattern. And then the wool is really good when you have a real fine and very good wool to work with. It really builds up your design and everything.
Many people who ended up settling into Taos and those regions of northern New Mexico consider that the Camino Real very much went northward, and that's the northern segment of the Camino Real. And it's those settlements that are also the result of those trade relations, whether it was goods that were being traded or people. The 18th century is when you have the largest number of captives being taken south by order of the governors. And it's mostly, it seems, the governors exchanging in this trade for any number of reasons, for bartering. There's one governor, I can't remember his name, who actually is using these captives to give his gifts to the elite of Mexico City. And other governors are sending them down to work in the mines down south. So you do have a fair number, Comanches, Apaches especially, being taken. Some even, because they're known to be unruly and to run away, a decree comes up, I think it's in the last part of the 18th century, that they really should be sent to Cuba. And indeed, some are sent to work in the sugarcane fields of Cuba.
Gradually, there was an intermingling of both cultural characteristics and bloodlines between the Spanish colonists and the Indians. This is known as the mestizaje, the mixture. It is from the word mestizaje that the term mestizo originated. Fran Levine gives us an interesting perspective on mestizaje.
The Matachinas dance, which is danced, of course, in Spanish and New Mexican communities, is the dance of mestizaje. It's that performance of the blending of cultures that is just a marvelous mixture. I love when I see Hispanic violin players playing with Pueblo drummers in some of these dances.
Charles Aguilar has long served as the mayor of the town of Bernalillo, an ancient community north of Albuquerque. His family have been involved with the Matachinas celebration of San Lorenzo for many decades.
What I understand is that the custom of the Fiesta de San Lorenzo started after the settlers of Bernalillo returned to the area around 1692. They brought with them the devotion to San Lorenzo. Our local priest here who had visited Mexico relayed to me that he had seen in some of the church archives where people paid a mass to San Lorenzo for the safe return of the people that were coming back to the area that had been settled before the Pueblo Revolt. I think that they picked up the custom because most of the people that were driven out stayed at Isleta del Sur. There is a devotion to San Lorenzo in that area. And so maybe that's the reason that it started here. But as far as how long it's been done here, I think it probably came with the people that came back to resettle. It's been in my family. My grandfather played off and on for about 65 years. I say off and on because there were two or three people in the community that could play the music. He went to California during the war to the shipyards. The men that remained here would play for the fiesta. I started in 58, actually started being taught the guitar to accompany the music of the Matachines. About 4 years before that, on August 1st, begins the Novena de San Lorenzo, which is a 9-day prayer in honor of San Lorenzo, culminating with the 9th day being the last day of the Novena, but also the Vespers for the feast on the 10th. And so the 9th begins with the last day of the Novena, and then there is the dancing of the Matachines right after the Novena.
South of Albuquerque is the town of Tomé, situated near one of the prominent landmarks along El Camino Real de Tierra Adentro, Tomé Hill. John Roney acquaints us with the importance of Tomé Hill.
Tomé Hill is a prominent landmark. It's this isolated volcanic hill that rises right up out of the floodplain between Belén and Las Lunas. So it's a real prominent geographic feature, and it's mentioned a lot of times in accounts of travel along the Camino Real. Originally, the river ran right at the base of the hill, and the hill is on the east side of the river. So as travelers were coming up on the east side of the river, they'd have to go around the hill. And that particular stretch where they'd have to come up out of the floodplain around the west side of the hill and then drop back to the floodplain on the other side was really sandy. And sand, of course, is difficult for these wheeled vehicles to negotiate. So for that reason, it's mentioned fairly often. Today, the river is really tame, but in the past, it was really a major force in nature, and it would change course frequently during the flood season. At some point, the river shifted away from the base of the hill, so traffic could just continue along the east bank of the river there without having to leave the floodplain. That happened sometime before 1740, and in 1740, a settlement was established, the settlement of Tomé, there very near the base of the hill.
Tomé is so central to the spiritual core of Belén. I've heard people in Belén say there is no separation between the church and the hill. It's one act of devotion. The hill gives the rocks that built the church. The church contains the sacrament, and then that sacrament is taken back to the hill to bless the hill, and the blessings of the hill are brought back to the church. It's a path, it's a pilgrimage path between the church and the hill and between the community and that hill. It's what roots people to that place, what gives them their identity as members of the parish in Belén. So I see it as one of those marvelous sacred places that we have in New Mexico. I think Tomé Hill is very much like the pilgrimage that takes place every year to Chimayo, the pilgrimage to the Zuni Salt Lake, some of the smaller pilgrimages like in the communities around Pecos where people walk to the smaller churches. We have a tradition here of walking, and it's a tradition that exists in Mexico and Spain as well, of making pilgrimages from chapel to chapel, from chapel to hilltop, from hilltop to some other resource. And that's how I see Tomé, as one of those spiritual hearts of New Mexico.
Para poder verte, ampáranos ahora y en la hora de la muerte.
1760, when Bishop Tamaron passed by there, the church was under construction, and that church is still there today. You know, it's been damaged and repaired, floods, you know, from time to time. But the church that you see there, as far as I know, is the one that was built there in the mid-1700s. In the mid-1800s, a lay Catholic organization called the Hermanos Penitentes became an important religious sect in this area. They emphasized the Passion of Christ, things like fasting, flagellation, reenactment of the Last Supper, the crucifixion, these kinds of things. And it's an organization that's had a lot of influence in New Mexico history in the early and mid-1800s. Sometime around 1947, three penitentes, at least one of them a World War II veteran, set up three crosses on top of Tome Hill. And over the years, that particular place has developed into the focal point of pilgrimages that involve not just Catholic, but people from other Christian faiths. It takes place on Good Friday, is sort of the main day when there are pilgrimages there and processions that go up. And on the summit of the hill, there are shrines and offerings. It's one of those places that I think expresses the spirituality that's a real important part of New Mexico. One of the three penitentes who established the crosses on top of Tome Hill in 1947 was Mr. Edwin Barry. ¿Dónde van para siempre a gozar los que creen
en Cristo Jesús? Tome Dominguez Mendoza settled Tome, and he had a few families living around him. They worked for him. He had like an hacienda. He was a captain in the Spanish army. His name was Tomé Domínguez y Mendoza. We don't know the year, but he came with the first colonists in 1610. And during the Pueblo Rebellion, his hacienda was abandoned. They all went down to Paso del Norte, and the Isleta Indians went down with them. 12 years later, they came back in the Reconquista with Don Diego de Vargas. But Tomé Domínguez did not come back. He was an old man, and by that time, his two sons got involved in cattle rustling around El Paso there. They became a little too ambitious, and Tomé Domínguez was too busy trying to save his two sons from the law, so he didn't come back. And the Campos and Maradiaga, who came along with de Vargas, settled the old hacienda. Only the walls were left, no roofs. And then it fell into ruin, and little by little, the bulldozers cleaned up the place, and there's nothing, no sign of it at all there. Except for now and then, you find some pottery and metates. Bolejo Romero has a very beautiful metate found right there on the hacienda of Tomé Domínguez Mendoza.
Sources differ. Some people say that that was a Genízaro settlement. Other people say it was a mixture of Genízaros and Spaniards. There was a lot of slavery in early New Mexico, and it involved a lot of children. The Spanish fought against the Indian tribes and vice versa, and both sides would take children captive and raise them in their households and use them as household servants. Among the Spanish colonists, it was their responsibility to raise them to be Christians and to enculturate them with Spanish culture, Hispanic culture. But they were racially full-blood Indian people, culturally Hispanic, racially Indian people. When they became of age to marry, they were essentially set free. The Spanish authorities used the Genízaros as sort of a buffer between the core Spanish colony and the hostile Indian nations, basically. So areas that were especially subject to Indian attack would often be settled by groups of Genízaros. The civil authorities would give them a grant of land that they could go live on and farm and settle. And sometimes they were real glad for that to happen, and other times they realized it was extremely perilous what they were being asked to do. Tome was apparently one of these. At least a portion of the population that settled there in 1740 were Genízaros.
Tome was resettled in 1739. 28 families from Albuquerque settled Tome in 1739, resettled. And all except one, all were Genízaros, except one. All were half Indians. And women, their wives, mostly were Spanish, but some were also Indian or half Indian. Genisaro is a half Indian or a misplaced Indian. He can be a full Indian but doesn't know, you know, he's a little orphan. He doesn't know if he's Navajo or what. Actually, you could tell. Navajo are different, but the Pueblo Indians were all very much the same. And Tomé was, especially Tomé and Jarales, Los Jarales de Belén, to resettle families, especially, particularly, Genisaro families, half Indians, or sometimes full Indians who didn't know where they belonged.
A lot of that mestizaje, if not most of the mestizaje, in our most recent century, comes precisely out of these captives that were living inside these households. Most of the women that were there ended up, as the records show, having children out of wedlock. So you see baptismal entry after baptismal entry showing padre no conocido, father unknown. But yet those children continued intermarrying within the Hispano families, so making the Hispano truly Indo-Hispano families.
Author and scholar Enrique Lamadrid has devoted many years to the study of mestizaje.
You get some mestizaje, of course, between Pueblo peoples and Spanish Mexicans, but because of the wars with other groups such as the Comanches and the Utes, those Shoshonian groups, and the Athabascan groups such as the Navajos and the Apaches, those wars were not resolved until well into the American period. The victims of that warfare, other people's kids who were taken as captives, there is a greater admixture, you could say, demographically speaking, with these Genisaros, as they come to be called. The census rolls and in popular usage, a Genisaro is one of these other people who's incorporated into Hispanic New Mexican society. By 1776, according to some historians, this accounts for fully one-third of the Spanish-Mexican population. So there's quite a bit of mestizaje. You could say there's probably more in the category of the Genisaros, previous Navajos, Apaches, Comanches, Utes. There's more mixture with those groups than with Pueblos. The Pueblos are kind of in a situation of being neighbors, and of course there's intermarriage there, but there's also quite a lot of mixing with these other groups.
The intercultural exchange that occurred in the 18th and 19th centuries is reflected in this song traditionally performed around Christmas by Hispanos. Los Comanchitos is performed by Brenda Romero, Enrique Lamadrid, Chuy Martinez, and Cipriano Vigil.
En el marco de esta puerta pongo un pie, pongo los de sus comanchitos, que no olvide cuántos son. Anaje, anaje, anaje yo, anaje, anaje, anaje yo, ane, ane yo, ane, ane yo, ane, ane yo, ane, ane yo, anaje, anaje, anaje yo, anaje, anaje, anaje yo, anaje yo, ane, ane yo.
Historian Esteban Rael Galvez first became interested in mestizaje when he was a child.
I grew up largely with two grandmothers continually whispering stories into my ear of who we were, and it was a story that was more than Mexicano, more than Español, more than even Indo-Hispano. Están quebrados en ti, my grandmother would say, and I gradually learned about these different captives that were in our family and that they would continue to pass down to me. One of these stories was told to me by my great-grandmother, Dulcinea Arellano, who always told me the same story when I would go visit her. She would say, talk to me about La India Panana. I would come to learn that Panana was a Spanish word for Pawnee. La India Panana, who didn't have a name then, had been captured by some Indian clan in the south, she would say, pointing with her lips south. She had been captured by them, and they also ended up capturing one of her great-great-grandfathers, whose name was Arellano. She told him, if you take me with you, I'll show you how to escape. And that's exactly what happened. They escaped and found their way, and that's how La Panana ended up in our family. La India, as the records show, married into the Arellano family and was living in Arroyondo. And so as I was trying to think about identity, a profound identity in northern New Mexico, I tried to reach deep into these stories, into a consciousness and a memory that had been passed down to me. And the more I started to dig into the records, the more I realized there was not a single family, not a single individual living in northern New Mexico that had not inherited this legacy.
The Lore of the Land is sponsored by the Museum of New Mexico Foundation and the New Mexico Department of Cultural Affairs. This segment is funded by a grant from the United States Bureau of Land Management with the ongoing support of the Ford Foundation. For the Lore of the Land, this is Jack Leffler. Thank you for listening.